Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com. Disco in Moscow.
Hi, my name is Anna Fishbein, and I am a playwright, actress, and founder of Exofeminist Productions, a company that focuses on feminist content in theater, film, and the web. And I am here in London to do a show called My Stubborn Tongue, which is a show that I wrote and I'm starring in. And it's the true story of my family's immigration to America at the height of the Cold War.
From Russia.
From Russia, yes.
Well, from the Soviet Union.
The former Soviet Union.
Yes, exactly. And I remember that time. Okay, so explain the circumstances under which you left the Soviet Union.
So in 1974, Russia signed an amendment with the United States to trade Jews for grain. And so Russia was getting grain.
They're like similar.
Yeah, because grain and Jews, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So half a dozen of one.
Yeah, exactly.
Six of the other.
Yeah, I wrote a poem once saying, how much grain did I cost? You know, it's an incredible fact that is really not known. And I wanted to tell that true story. It was a very scary time in 1974. But once Jewish people learned that they could get out of Russia, they began applying to the KGB, requesting permission to leave. And you took real chances. Most people had to leave their jobs. You were followed. We were, for instance, followed by the KGB. My grandfather was attacked by the KGB at the time.
Because you sort of, in order to get out,
yes,
you had to name yourself as Jewish and desiring to leave.
Exactly, which instantly made you a traitor.
Yeah.
And so once you became...
How long did it take before you're like, hey, you put your head up over the parapet. Yeah, I'm a target.
So they decided how long, and it was a completely random process. And so some people, if you got refused, you were screwed for a long time.
And under what basis was it completely arbitrary? Were there known reasons why?
If somebody was a physicist or somebody who worked for the government, you were most likely, we knew people who were refused for like 13 years, which meant that you were in this sort of purgatory of not being able to find a job and also not being able to leave. We got out on a fluke, honestly, and people got, sometimes you got lucky, and we got lucky, and people got out randomly. So in 1981, when the Soviet Union closed the doors to Jewish immigration, we got our permission to leave, and my father had a high position in a computer firm.
But he was in a technical, that, you know, but was it at the time like they didn't think computers were going to own everything, or that it was such specialist information?
You know, I'm not really sure. I know that, for instance, it was difficult. He had to resign from the Communist Party. He had to be in the Communist Party in order to head that.
To have the gig in the first
place. Exactly. So you couldn't have had the high position that he did without being part of the Communist Party. And my grandfather served in the war, and he was part of the Communist Party. And so they had to extricate themselves, which was an entirely horrible process.
Well, because that's your entire social life. That's your that's everything.
Exactly.
Well, it's that's like, your social standing,
and you're accepted. You know, this is how you're part of the society. You know, most people were, and when you came to the United States, people didn't want to say, you know, that they were part of that at the time. And I talk about that in the show. Mm. I call it finally coming out about the Communist Party.
Yeah. Right? RadioGorgeous.com.
But I remember in the 80s, because I was alive.
Yeah.
I am that old. No.
No.
But I remember in the 80s, by the train station in White Plains, there was a sign. There was a lot of propaganda. But maybe that's because I was around New York. A lot of people around us were Jewish. A lot of people weren't Jewish. But at the same time, there was a poster. I remember a poster, you know, to try and help get Jews out of Russia.
And we were helped by that movement. I mean, I remember that there were marches in Chicago, Action for Soviet Jews, because we went to Chicago, and there was a huge community of American Jews who fought for the Russian Jews to get out in the 80s and like late 70s. Mm-hmm. And that helped us enormously. I mean, those marches and all those people fighting and writing to senators. I mean, it was two senators who wrote the amendment that helped us get out, Jackson and Vanek. And it was called the Jackson-Vanek Amendment, which was the law that actually made the trade. So it's an incredible thing, but people, but voters supported it. And so that's how it actually happened.
Wow. And that, I mean, just, you're not allowed to sell people, but in this sense, we were willing to, you know, we were selling you for good. You know?
Right, exactly. And it was an incredible moment because nobody else could get out of Russia except for the Jews in that period from 1974 to 1980, 1981, you know. And the reason why it ended was because of the Afghanistan war and all relations between Russia and America broke down.
Right. Okay, and so then you get to America, and you're like hugely, I imagine your family's hugely grateful, like, wow, you know, especially for Jews, you turned down money, you know, for your grain, and you got us. You could have made money out of this deal, and instead, hey, you know, it better work. And so what did you find when you arrived in the promised land?
You can't speak a word of English, you know. You find they have no money. You find that, you know, you're living in some of the worst neighborhoods in whatever city you enter. And you know, you're pretty scared, and it's a completely different society. And conceptually, it was a very different society because in Russia, because of communism, the government took care of you. The government gave us an apartment, and we lived in the apartment that the government gave us. There were so many things that were taken care of for you. And then you come to America, and you have to find your own apartment. You have to get your own job. And every little thing in America, getting a driver's license, every little move like of individualism is like a mountain to climb for you.
Yeah.
Because you can't conceive of it. You don't understand that you're just on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, this freedom lark, you know, it has some downsides.
Exactly. You
know? Well, but I think that's why, you know, Russia's gone back. They like a dictator. We like to be, you know what I mean? We like to tell us what to do.
Yeah, tell us what to do, yeah. You know, it's a different texture of society. It's a different concept. It's a different approach to the everyday, honestly.
And as much as you were, you know, you were loathed in Russia, you didn't realize that you were loathed, but, you know.
In America. Sort of,
but knew the rules.
Yes,
You knew why you were loathed, how you were loathed, what it looked like. Oh, wow. So they don't like us here either.
Exactly. So we came here. We came here, and it was incredible because we thought, here we are. We're these refugees. We fled here. We love you. We love you, America. You know, and the first thing that happens is we talk in Russian. I will never forget this. We went to a pizza place, and we had a waitress, and she came up to us, and she said, "What language do you guys speak?" And I remember my mom said, Greek, French, Polish. We tried like every language, you know. And then finally, so one of us said Russian, and the waitress said Russian, and she ran away, and she never returned.
You're kidding?
No, never returned. We never got service in that restaurant.
No pizza for you.
No pizza for us. And people would scream on the streets. You know, people would hear the language and they would scream because they knew the language from James Bond movies.
Right.
So they knew what it sounded like.
Yes.
And they would scream on the street, commies, go back home, go back to Russia. Are you KGB spies? Tell us, are you KGB spies?
Wow.
That's what it was
like. That's embarrassing.
No, it was rough. In school, I was constantly called commie. And
how old were you when you arrived in Chicago?
I was 9, and I didn't speak a word of English, so that wasn't easy.
And so when did you feel, like, you know, did you feel like you finally fit in high school, or do you now?
I never fit in. I'm an original. No, I'm kidding. I actually worked, so the story of my stubborn tongue is how hard I worked to fit in, and in fact, I learned the English language in 1 year and became fluent in 1 year. I was a straight-A Russian student, and I became a straight-A American student. And I studied very hard, and by the third year in America, nobody could tell that I was Russian, and I began to pass and lie. I officially changed my name to Annie, and I became Annie Fishbein, and for a long time, I would just... you know, just pretend that I knew what the Partridge Family was, or pretend that, you know, I had watched all these other shows that all the other kids were familiar with.
I was saying, I did that too, because my parents, we had one black and white TV, and we weren't allowed to watch anything on it anyway, except for opera and baseball or tennis.
Right.
So it was like, I was like, oh yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, sure. You know?
That's exactly what I did.
No idea what people are talking about.
Exactly.
But all those cultural references.
That's right.
You know, sort of like the Communist Party. You know, there's those are the things that surround you.
Yeah.
And either, you know, include or exclude you.
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, so that's exactly what it was like. And so sort of pretending that I knew the cultural references. And it was an incredible feat being able to sort of fit in. Mm. The only time that I was outed is when my parents would show up and start talking in a big, thick Russian accent. Who are those people? I don't know. I don't know why they're taking me home.
Yeah, I feel bad for them.
Yeah.
Over 2,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Thanks, darlings. Mwah.
Who all came over from Russia? Because you were talking about your grandfather.
So my grandfather actually died after he got attacked by the KGB. He died very soon after that. They broke his jaw, and eventually, and he almost immediately after that had a heart attack.
Right.
And so he never got a chance to come. He really wanted to come to America. Mm. And it was my grandmother, my aunt, my dad, my mom, and me. It was the five of us.
Wow. And so were there tensions? Did people settle in differently?
Yes. My grandmother probably had the hardest time because English never... I mean, even at the end of her life, she still didn't speak any English. Mm. My mother was a dentist in Russia and couldn't find a job in America. And my father was in computers, and he got a job immediately. And so he did the best. I mean, he fit in very well. But I would say everybody had a hard time. Mm-hmm. My parents had a very difficult time. And I was sort of, in the beginning, the conduit to American society. I was the person who would translate things, would translate for them, would translate in movies.
And were you, you know, embarrassed by their Russianness once you had fully, you know, sort of seen yourself... You know, because, I mean, but that's what kids do. That's what people do.
Yeah.
You know? That's generational tensions anyway.
You know, it's funny. I was never embarrassed by the Russianness. I was just embarrassed by the parentedness.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Like normal embarrassment.
Yeah, like normal embarrassment. I remember just like wanting to seem cool and wanting like I didn't need my parents. I immediately sort of adapted to the American cool. I wanted to be like Madonna and Michael Jackson and Prince. And I was all into that. You know, the biggest embarrassment was like having mom be the chaperone, not because mom had a huge Russian accent, just because it was mom.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But then in college, I instantly outed myself. I came to college and I was like, that's it. I'm going back to Anna. Officially changed my name back.
Yeah. Well, because that's the time for self-expression anyway. You
know what I
mean? Like, high school is the epitome of conformity. And then it's just like, you know what?
Yeah.
Back to me.
Exactly.
Tell me about... Sorry, the production company is...
Yeah, Exofeminist Productions. That's right.
Exofeminist Productions. Tell me about Happy Hour Feminism.
Yes. So it's a show that is crazy.
Yeah,
no. So I've been interested in feminism for a long time, ever since the birth of my children. I would say that I fully became a feminist when I gave birth to my children, because I discovered that I really understood in a really sort of visceral way that the world is not equal. And since then, my first play was called Sex in Mommyville, which was, you know, about a mom who wants to juggle her career, her sex life, and her marriage and her children, who actually wants to have sex but can't. You know, can't get to it.
Through the nappy.
Yeah, exactly. The sleepless.
I'm coming. No, actually, I'm not.
I'm not coming. Exactly. And you know, the play was a comedy, and it was a family comedy. And in the midst, there were all these sort of feminist diatribes throughout the play where she is transformed and becomes stronger through the process. And for a long time, I kind of grappled with feminist issues within the context of a woman talking about feminist issues, and I got a lot of responses to that play. And I thought to myself, you know, I have been observing the arguments amongst women all the time about the stay-at-home moms and the working moms, the talk about women being objectified, you know, and I've been so rattled by the fact that we women are constantly talking just with each other, that we are not able to impart what's happening to us to the larger society, to men, essentially. And I just wanted to take the world and reverse it. I just wanted to make men feel what it might be like to be a woman. And I created a show where I just took this concept and took it to the final. And the things that bug me, for instance, is when I turn on the TV and I'm watching a movie, every other commercial is, how can you, Anna, look younger? How can you be thinner? How can you be prettier? Every single commercial is aimed at sort of either A, objectifying a woman, B, making her younger, you know, C, making her thinner. And just the entire society is constantly focused on that. You know, I was also, you know, recently there's something that came out about Cindy Crawford. Oh my God. You know, big news. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to do. You know, these images have just come out about Cindy Crawford, unphotoshopped images of Cindy Crawford. And I was thinking to myself, who the fuck cares?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, so what?
No.
Woman was on a beach.
Yeah.
Wait, why is this news? Why is everyone discussing? And why is the discussion just internal to us? And so what I did was I thought of a show where women are actually on top. And we don't ask the question of how she looks, what she's wearing. We don't talk about what she's wearing. We just look at the men. Let's see if we can find creams for men. Right. Dieting beer for men, get rid of their beer bellies, think about how they can be sexually more alluring for us, and do it in a comedic way. You know, I don't want to bang anybody over the head. Let's just have fun with it. But for one second, imagine a reversed world. And so one of the things that we have is, oh my God, unphotoshopped images of George Clooney, you know, or Ryan Seacrest, or, you know, and so that's what the show sort of does. Right. And it sort of has a kind of fun feel. And so in the show, for instance, I thought about this a great deal. I dress how I like to dress, which is sexy, you know, but because the lens is not interested in me, the lens is not, it doesn't matter what I wear, and it shouldn't be an issue at all what I'm wearing, because constantly what women are grappling with is, oh well, why did she wear this, or why was she naked in this? Because if the lens isn't interested in you as the object, and if the lens is suddenly turned onto the men, it's a completely different world. You know, and so I was interested in that sort of concept. And it was interesting working with men on this.
Yeah, they say. And who are some of your cast members?
So I had Catherine Cates from Orange is the New Black. I had Anthony Lasuria. I worked with both Catherine and Anthony on Sex and Mommyville, and I knew they were fantastic actors. And I had a lot of other really, really amazing actors. And Anthony Lasuria was the secretary to Nookie on Boardwalk Empire. And he is just phenomenally funny. And on our show, he plays the butler, the ancient butler, who represents the ancient man. So if you can imagine, our show is taking place like 100 years into the future. Right? But Anthony is still objectifying women.
You know? Right, so he's Cro-Magna man.
Exactly. So, so we brought in male models for the show. We don't have a single show where there's not a naked man. I mean, not naked, not in the buff, but, you know, in shorts or in underwear. Yeah. But we usually have, I kind of called it the Victoria's Secret of men, our angels.
Because like, you know, some random, like, why was she wearing, you know what I mean? As you're saying, when the camera is focused on you, you don't notice what men are wearing, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, in some ways, it didn't matter. Like, if I was wearing a short skirt or another woman on the show was wearing a short skirt, it didn't really matter because the men are practically in the buff. And all you look at is the men. And that is exactly what it's like for women. Right. It doesn't matter what a man is wearing in that video or on that show, because if she's wearing a lot less and the camera focuses on her and her legs and it stares at them in a certain kind of way, then it's
especially
about...
Especially if they don't have a face attached. And they're only legs. You know?
Exactly.
Radio Gorgeous. Podcasts for women.
One of the things I was really interested in, we were very lucky. We got a male model who's also a virtuoso violin player. And so he plays the violin on our show. And it interested me very much because Miss America has these women come out in their bathing suits, but they also have extraordinary talents. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how fun would it be? a little Miss America contest, you know? I just wanted to touch upon all these social issues that surround women and give them a bit of a, comedic relief.
Yeah. Well, sort of looking at something from a different angle.
Exactly. Exactly.
And how have the men responded?
So I worked on this piece. I co-created this. I wrote the piece and a man directed the piece and we co-created the piece together. And it was very helpful for me. I mean, I knew the director is a Romanian director and we had a very similar sense of humor. And, number one project was that it was comedy. But to my great surprise, I found myself thinking, is this too much? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, he'd be like, we don't care.
But isn't that interesting that you were self-censoring, like, oh, you could, but whereas if it's a woman, you're like, yeah, sure, you can treat her like that.
Exactly. In other words, it was helpful to have a man because he almost said to me, don't worry about that.
Yeah, because we don't worry about it.
Because we don't worry about it. Like, it's okay if you abuse in this way. Because it was funny. And if it was funny and if it was comedic,
then it's allowed.
And also, I once in a great while, he would say, well, let's just keep focus on the feminist issue, And I was like, wait.
Who said that?
Wait, who said that?
I did not say that.
Yeah, exactly.
That was not my voice.
Exactly. And it was, it was interesting to work with men and watch how men and the other men on the set, both the crew and the actors, mm-hmm. So one of the things that would happen sometimes is the men, there was this one moment, this great moment where the virtuoso violin player who played the model said to us, we have an outtake that we were thinking of putting in, but said to all of us, he said, do I have a line? And the ladies looked at each other and said, now ladies, if we had a female model on the set, would she have a line?
Yeah.
And somebody said, fuck no.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we turned to him and we said, sorry.
Does it have any carryover then, sort of what moments, like in your everyday life, so then there you are walking down the street and you're like, oh God, back to reality.
Right, exactly. And it would be like that on set sometimes. Somebody on the set would say, Hey, remember we're at HHF. It's not like that here.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it was an interesting thing that we don't live in that reality at all. We have our fourth episode is about two dads arguing with each other about what it's like. One is a working dad and the other one is a stay-at-home dad. And they have this war over who does more, And, the sound engineer came up to me and he said, when I first was asked to work on the show, I didn't know what it was. And he said, I didn't know if this was going to be like a man-hating show or is this going to be like a anti-feminist show or what was this? Yeah. And he said, I got to this show and I realized how ridiculous some of the things are in our society from just watching you turn it all around.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we women are struggling amongst each other about whether who's doing more, the stay-at-home mom versus the working mom. Have we ever seen dads talk about this or argue about this? No. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just don't even have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And do they during their, happy hour just spend all their time talking about, kids and, you're doing more, now I'm doing more.
Are they eating?
Exactly. Exactly.
And so I'm sleeping through the night.
Yeah, exactly.
Shut the fuck up. I don't care. So where can we see Happy Hour Feminism?
So Happy Hour Feminism will be going on YouTube. And it will be going on the ExoFeminist channel. We have an ExoFeminist website, ExoFeminist.com. It will be premiering on that channel on April 15th.
Fantastic.
And that will be the first episode. And we will also be, it will be our official premiere as at the Trouble Club, where we'll be showing the first episode for the first time.
Fantastic. And your show, My Stubborn Tongue?
My Stubborn Tongue. You can get tickets to My Stubborn Tongue at eventbrite.com under My Stubborn Tongue in London, April 16th and 17th. Please do come.
Thank you, Anna Fishbein.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I have loved speaking with you.
Yeah.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com and beautifully edited by Ella Gray Thomas, 2015.